Paradise Radio for the Seeker.
Everyone, thank you for tuning in. A warm welcome. This is Red Ice Radio, and my name is Henrik Palmgren. Today we're going to listen to Charles Eisenstein on economy, monetary systems, nature, human nature, climatism, competition, laws, and government. He graduated from Yale University with a degree in mathematics and philosophy. Most of his early 20s were spent in Taiwan, where he learned Chinese and worked as a translator. He educated himself in Eastern spiritual traditions and read a lot of books on health, nutrition, globalization, physics, and biology. In his late 20s, he entered into what he describes being a long period of intensifying crisis. His professional work became intolerable, and after this, Charles entered a long period of searching. This crisis forced him to let go of a life under control. And in his helplessness, he discovered a generous universe that has always met his needs somehow in unexpected ways. He spent time teaching yoga, learning about herbs, and teaching at Penn State's Department of Science, Technology, and Society. And today we'll talk about his book, Sacred Economics, and some of the ideas behind it. Charles Eisenstein, good to talk to you. Thank you for coming on Red Ice Radio.
Yeah, great to be here, Henrik. Thanks.
You bet. Now, of course, you have a lot of different work behind you. Most recently, you've focused on the material that comes out of your book, Sacred Economics. And I want to kind of ask you about your interest, I guess, in economics and some of your ideas and philosophy, etc. What the background to that was. Was this anything that kind of came to you during your time at Yale, or have you always had this interest, Charles?
No, it really didn't have anything to do with my education. I've never taken a course in economics, but I was kind of brought up in that, in those issues and in that conversation, because my father was a political science professor, and so we would talk about, E.F. Schumacher and Henry George and people like that, around the dinner table even. So it's kind of in my DNA. But I turned to the issue because really my interest is in how do we transform this planet and what is the root of the crisis that we're facing. And I'm not saying that money is the root of it, but money is pretty deeply implicated in pretty much everything that we see going on today. When you start to dig under, why is there a war looming in Syria? Why are we fracking everywhere? Why are we expelling indigenous people from their rainforests? You dig a little bit and it doesn't take long before you realize that somebody's making money. So I wanted to really understand what it is about money that seems to be such a force for evil. And understanding that, how could we change money so that it's no longer that, and instead that it's aligned with the beautiful things that we want to do?
Indeed, very good. Now, give us an outline what you mean then by sacred economics, and of course we'll get to, deeper into many of these issues as we go here, Charles.
Well, it's simply to make money sacred, just like everything else, to align it with what is becoming sacred to us today. In the past, for industrial civilization, what was sacred was the growth of the human realm, the conquest of nature, the fulfillment of the ideal of the individual. These were our cultural mythology. These were what humanity was striving toward. But that view of the sacred has changed. No longer do we aspire, at least explicitly, to the conquest of nature, although those habits are still with us. But now our our sense of the sacred is turning again toward reverence for nature, the desire to heal nature, to co-evolve with nature, the understanding that we're all, in some sense, we're all one, we're interconnected, we're interdependent, we're interexistent even. And so as our consciousness changes, our money has to change too. And right now it hasn't. So right now, many, many people feel the urge to do something beautiful with their lives, to do something sacred, you know, to devote their life energy towards something meaningful to them. And those expressions of their life energy very often are at odds with the money system. Like, there's not a lot of money in that. There's lots of money in cutting down rainforests and drilling for minerals there, you know, mining minerals and drilling for oil, which is what's happening in Ecuador and Colombia and Bolivia and Brazil. There's not a lot of money in seeking to protect those areas. So why is that? A sacred economy would have the money be there. You know, it would have, you wouldn't have to sacrifice your physical security and well-being for the sake of doing what you love. You'd be able to do what you love and know that you would be taken care of too. That's what a sacred economy would look like.
Definitely. I've heard you also talk about the limits to the endless spiraling upwards, the growth cycle. That this is something that's also been kind of incorporated into the model of the current economics, is that it always needs to grow exponentially, or not exponentially, but you know, it needs to be gains all the time, you know, yields, etc. But if we look around in nature, Charles, we understand that nothing works like this. Okay, a tree grows upward all the time, but it has its cycles of coming and going, if you will. It sheds its leaves, etc. Nature goes into winter at time of not growing. So how would you compare the natural systems, I guess, with the system, an artificial one that we have of economics right now?
Yeah, I mean, our money system only works if there's growth. And it pretty much does have to be exponential growth. I'm not going to go too deeply into the reasons now, but it has to do with interest and the way that money is created as interest-bearing debt. So money and the economy have to keep growing, and if they don't, then you have concentration of wealth, unemployment, and so forth. This is part of kind of that myth I was describing before, the myth of human conquest of nature, where it's the destiny of humanity to grow and to own everything, to make all of nature ours, to convert everything out there into some kind of resource. And eventually what happens is it gets converted into some kind of property. And economic growth, what that is precisely the conversion of nature into property. It's the conversion of nature into goods and services that you pay for. Oil still on the ground or trees still in the forest, that's not an economic good unless it's bought and sold for money. So this growth paradigm, it's beyond just economics. But obviously we're reaching the end of it. Just like, I mean, actually in nature, there is such a thing as exponential growth or rapid growth, but it's only temporary. It's one phase of a larger process.
Right.
A child will go through a rapid growth stage, and an immature ecosystem will go through a rapid growth stage. But then it reaches an equilibrium point, a steady state point, where the growth tapers off, and there's a transition to a new state of being, which is what I think humanity is going through right now.
And why is that? Why at this time, do you think, Charles? Because if there is a, change, as so many people have been talking about, in consciousness, in awareness or perception, what have you, then obviously everything that we do is going to be reflected in those changes and evolutions. But what do you think is driving that, if you will?
Well, I mean, certainly one thing that's driving it is that we're reaching the limits of growth. Even if we try as hard as we can to keep growing, we're not going to be able to do it because of the ecological limits and, less well-recognized, the social limits. There's only a certain amount of community that you can convert into services before there's no community left. And in the industrialized countries, we're reaching that point where you have whole neighborhoods where almost nobody knows anybody else. And if you know them, you don't need them because you're paying for everything that you need. Neighbors don't even need to help each other anymore. Because all of these functions, like childcare, like, you know, repairs and fixing things, entertainment, all of these things have been converted into paid services. So whereas 100 years ago, people would get together and sing and play the piano or do things like that for their entertainment, now they purchase music. Whereas children used to gather outside and play imaginative games now and have adventures, now they play those online and purchase the things that were once part of what I would call a gift economy. Whereas people once cooked food from scratch, now they buy prepared food and bring it home or they eat at restaurants. Whereas people once, for medicine, would go to the local grandmother who knew a lot about herbs and folk medicine and would take care of most of their problems, you know, now they are helpless. People are helpless. They've been disempowered and de-skilled, and so they have to go to a doctor. And so you look in every realm, and you find that there's a migration of life from the gift realm to the money realm. This process cannot go on forever, and we're reaching the end of it right now. And just as the ecological limits are causing tremendous stress now and suffering, which has been mostly so far relegated to the third world and to poor people and stuff, it's now encroaching into the, you know, fortresses of the wealthy as well. So also the effects of reaching the social limits to growth are invading the American dream or the Western dream of the perfect self-sufficient individual life, where people are just feeling so lonely, you know, and so disconnected and wanting to reconnect. And the results are depression and suicide and violence, domestic violence. You know, you take people and you shut them up inside a box. And of course, that's a recipe for violence. And so, you know, we're reaching the limits to growth. And that's one of the things that's propelling us into a different consciousness, you could say. The old world isn't working very well. And so we're reaching for a new world, which is also very ancient. And in fact, part of the attraction to the indigenous and to ancient cultures is this search for meaning, search for belonging, search for a new story that tells us who we are and why we're here. We haven't gotten there yet. We're just at the beginning of this transition into adulthood, into an era where we're not growing and growing anymore, but we reach a steady state in terms of population, in terms of how much of the Earth's resources we're using, and we develop in other ways.
The, I guess, you know, in a way, then the ecosystem would be the ultimate judge of how we could live and how many of them we could be. And this, of course, is the harsh way about it, the non-thinking approach to it, of course. But, you know, there are examples of this in nature when, and of course, man has been involved in this, when you know, deer was introduced on this one remote island. I forget which one it was or where it was, but we talked about it before in the program, but basically showed how the deer basically, you know, ate everything off the entire island until there was nothing left to eat. And then eventually they started to die off, and eventually there were no deer left. And so, I mean, and that's of course a very brutal way about it. But is that where you see things going if we don't change this? I mean, is it as simple as saying that we're simply too many humans on the planet, or is it simply how we live, Charles?
Yeah, there's a few questions in there. I mean, one, you know, I don't think that overpopulation is the fundamental problem. We could have half the current population, but if everybody lives a North American lifestyle, the planet would still be screwed. And we could have the current population if everybody lived the lifestyle of a traditional peasant in India, we could be okay. So I don't think that reducing population is this magic bullet that's going to save our situation. Although I do see that that population growth is slowing down. It's probably going to reach its peak in the next 30 years and then begin a long, steady decline until it levels off. Ideally, I don't know, 2 or 3 billion maybe, if we really practice permaculture and these deep, sustainable technologies and regenerative technologies, even more than sustainable. So I don't think that we necessarily will face the scenario, you know, of the deer destroying the basis of their sustenance on the island, although that kind of thing has happened before to humanity. I mean, Jared Diamond writes about this. And there certainly is that possibility. How bad does it have to get before we really embrace a new consciousness? It's like asking the question, how bad does it have to get before the alcoholic gives up drinking?
Right.
For some, it doesn't happen until the deathbed. For others, it happens with some other shock that's not as bad. Maybe the first time they're in jail or their wife leaves them or they have a health crisis and they're like, oh, this I've hit, you know, they hit bottom. They feel utterly helpless and they surrender. And well, there are many maps of this process, but how do you know or what distinguishes the addict who hits bottom on the deathbed and the addict who hits bottom somewhere higher up? What distinguishes them? If we can understand that and translate that onto a collective level, then maybe we can raise bottom for humanity.
So what would you say is driving this process of wanting to live under the conditions that most people seem to strive for on the planet with all the materialistic comforts that we can imagine? What is driving that, do you think?
Well, we have this ideology that we're doing pretty well, at least the wealthy are doing pretty well because they have all these material comforts. But these material comforts are a cover and a false compensation for many things that are acutely missing in our culture. The sense of belonging, the feeling of having enough time, having a wealth of time, the freedom to play, the freedom to explore, the sense of being at home in the universe, having a wealth of intimacy, connection to other people, connection to nature. These things are missing from modern life. And lacking them, we reach out for the substitutes that are pervaded to us by, you know, advertising and material culture in general. But pretty much anybody will tell you that these are not what makes a person happy. And in fact, the fully monetized life cuts us off even more, you know, from what we really need. So I think that as change makers, it's important to understand that we're not actually telling people you're going to have to make do with less of the good stuff. Sustainability isn't less of the same. It's less of what you really don't need and really don't want, and more of what is cryingly missing from modern life. You know, like here in America, just to give you one example, the size of an average dwelling has increased by something like 100, 150% since the 1950s. Our houses are much bigger. But people are not happy in those houses with their gigantic living rooms. What we really want is other people. Public space has almost disappeared. Except in poor neighborhoods, you don't see people out on the street in a lot of places in America now. All you see is cars. And people are, you know, you see a garage door open, you see a car drive out, the garage door closes. Many people never even use their front door. And they're trapped inside in the summer by air conditioning, in the winter by heating. There's no social life. There's no outdoor cafes with people walking up and down the street, you know, and like that kind of street life. And and there's not the life where you can just kind of walk over to a neighbor's house and knock on the door and just show up. You know, it's even rude sometimes to make a telephone call. You know, you got to set that up with email or a text or something like that. And so this cutoff from intimacy with other people in nature is misery. What a human being is meant to experience in this life is the sense of being immersed in a web of relationships. For most of history, every face you saw was intimately familiar to you. You knew every story behind every face. And they knew you equally well. Everything about you, there was no hiding. And so you could be completely comfortable in who you were. And every bird that you saw, you would know what its song was. And you would know all of its habits. It would be an intimate friend, in a way. Every feature of the landscape had hundreds of stories attached to it. Mythological stories that told you your place in the universe. And just, you know, personal stories. Stories of what happened to so-and-so when he fell down the hill, you know, or fell through the ice in the pond. And maybe your first sexual encounter happened, you know, in that woods over there. And so, you know, we were immersed in a web of relationship. And when we're cut off from that and rendered into these narrow, separate selves, these individuals, we're hungry to recover our lost being. One reason for consumerism is this attempt to expand the separate self in order to recover the infinity of the connected self. And of course, that's impossible. No matter how much you add to the finite, you never reach the infinite. That's actually an addictive pattern. Getting more and more and more, higher and higher doses of what you don't actually need. And it just makes the pain go away temporarily. That's the situation we're in. And so to change the world, we need to offer people not just, you know, hey, you know, you're destroying the planet, you should consume less, but really to come at it with, I want your life to be more beautiful. I want you to be happier. When we're coming from there, then there's not like this kind of self-righteousness that we often detect in activists. You know, like, I'm riding a bike and you're driving a car, you know, shame on you. Like, people don't respond well to that.
Right. Yeah. Well, exactly. There's a couple of, I watched one of your recent videos. You brought up some interesting points on that. I actually want to return to that later as well and ask you about that, and including like how you would see, you know, a reform taking place, basically. But before that, if the current then monetary system, as you see it, then is kind of channeling some of these problematic aspects of human nature, ultimately, I guess that's, you know, that's kind of what we're talking about. Or maybe, you know, and then you can specify that if these are external influences put upon people, etc. But how would any system, I guess, that we set up work or be able to be kind of outside of this aspect of human nature? Everything we're going to touch or everything we're going to be part of is going to channel these same internal processes, whether we have kind of dealt with the issues or not, correct?
Well, the challenge before us, okay, so I see the process happening in essentially two phases. One is the breakdown of the old story, for example, the story of money and the monetary system and everything built on that story. And then the second is an emergence into a new story, a new way of perceiving the world, and new institutions that are built on that new story. So right now, even if we're trying to, or you know, on an individual level, making some kind of transition and seeing the world differently, money and also education and healthcare and politics and many other forces are trying to pull us back, trying to keep us in the old story. So I've been speaking in a lot of generalities, and I want to make it clear that you know, this isn't just about something, you know, quote, spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question is, well, okay, exactly, what is it exactly about money that enforces separation and endless growth? And what could money exactly look like? Like, how do we exactly have to change it
right.
in order to promote community, cooperation, collaboration, ecological regeneration, and so forth? And so that's what the book is about. So I describe, for example, I mean, I'll just give you one example of what happens in an interest-based money system. So money is created as interest-bearing debt, which means at any moment, there's always more debt than there is money.
Yeah.
Because money's lent into existence. So the bank lends you, I don't know, €1 million, and now you owe, say, over 10 or 15 years, you owe €2 million. Where are you going to get that extra million? Well, you're going to earn it from other people, right? No problem. You pay it back. But everybody's in the same boat. Everybody's always competing with each other for never enough. And the only way to avoid half the people going bankrupt in 10 or 15 years is to lend even more money into existence in the intervening time with even more debt. But that's okay, because by the time that comes due, even more will have been lent into existence. So you can have, you still have a few bankruptcies, but in general, you have everything working as long as there's growth. So that's how it, in a nutshell, that's how our money system fosters growth. As for separation and competition, again, like, we're all in competition for not quite enough money. So it's like this game that we play as children, musical chairs. Have you ever played that?
Yeah, sure.
You know, so there's like, I don't know, 15 people and 14 chairs. So everybody scrambles for a chair when the music stops. And you see people maybe elbowing each other and being aggressive and competitive. Is that because of human nature? Or is that a response to the setup? Would people behave like that if there were 15 chairs or 16 chairs? They probably wouldn't. Would people behave like that if missing out on the chair was no big deal? And the person who missed out on the chair got hugs and kisses from everybody else. Then you wouldn't have the competitive behavior either. But our money system is like a game of musical chairs where if you miss the chair, then you don't get to eat, or you have to suffer in some way. You get creditors hounding you and making your life miserable. So what we're seeing is human nature. Yeah, I mean, it is a part of human nature, but it's also a response to conditions. Specifically, to a large extent, it's a response to the conditions of our money system. So, and this is just one piece of how the money system alienates us from each other and compels us to find something in nature to convert into money, you know, do something to elbow somebody else out and get that extra chair. So if we changed the way that money is created and no longer made it artificially scarce in that way, then what we see as human nature would change, or we would see a different aspect of human nature expressing itself. There's a bunch of proposals for creating money that's not fundamentally scarce and that doesn't generate more competition than is necessary. The one I describe in my book is a system based on negative interest money, where if you hold on to it, it slowly gets less and less valuable, kind of like inflation. Therefore, if you want to stay wealthy, you need to share it, maybe lend it at zero interest. And the details are a little complicated. And I can go into them more if you want.
Definitely. Exactly. Let's definitely do that, Charles. I wanted to kind of break that down a little bit. Let me ask you a few things before we proceed, because I think it's an interesting also, you know, philosophical kind of conversation here in terms of, you know, of course, the, you know, when you see that there's problems in the world of how to go about to influence those or to break them down, to understand them and to be able to see in what direction you need to go to be able to improve, if you will, on those problems. If we draw this back to nature again, because there might be people listening and saying, you know, that this the approach then of, you know, competition is something that we have in nature. I've heard you talk about this in a different way of a gift instead. Let's do the example of, you know, in nature, the gazelle is eaten by the lion, you know, and then so in some cases the philosophy that a lot of people have is that this is the struggle of life and death happening right there. It's at the same point. This could be other examples. The slug eats the spinach leaf or the whale eats the krill, what have you. It's kind of based on that idea, and therefore the system that we have in as humans are going to kind of be based on that idea. What would you say to that then?
Well, I mean, nobody's denying that there is competition in nature. The question is, can we describe nature as fundamentally this gigantic competition of each against all? Like, is that the nature of nature? Or is that just one aspect of nature? So I was at this retreat, you know, and we went, and it was by the ocean, and we went down there a couple times that day. There were these cliffs, you know, there was a path down, and there were these rocks, and the waves were coming up. It was really beautiful, and there were these seagulls that were standing on these boulders, and they weren't really doing anything. They were just kind of standing there. Some of them were grooming themselves. They were making their noises, you know. Sometimes, once in a while, when we could fly up, fly and fly away, maybe look for food or something. But like, most of them were just standing there for a long, long time. We came back hours later, and they were still there, the same ones, you know, because I recognized them. They were all slightly different. At least I think they were the same ones. And I said, there we are. There's the struggle to survive.
Right.
People used to think that primitive life, hunter-gatherer life, was a struggle to survive. That life was really hard, you know, nasty, brutish, and short, and that we were barely getting by because we didn't have technology and science and stuff. But then when anthropologists actually studied these people, they found that they enjoyed enormous amounts of leisure time and had a very nonchalant attitude about the future and shared any, if they had more than they needed, they would share it with others. They wouldn't hold on to possessions and try to control possessions. And they were really baffled. They're like, where's the struggle to survive? Richard Lee, the anthropologist Richard Lee, he was so baffled by it, he decided that he was going to follow them around and keep a notebook and log how much time they actually spent on subsistence. And this was the Kalahari Desert, you know, where they get, you know, 6 inches of rain a year. And it was a drought year. So if there were ever a struggle to survive on Earth, it should be there. And they were working 19 or 20 hours a week per adult. And this work wasn't even arduous. For the men, it consisted a lot of it going out hunting, which is people do for leisure today. For the women, you know, they would go out gathering, there'd be the kids around, they'd be chatting, you know, working at a leisurely pace, and they were eating a perfectly adequate diet. So yeah, competition is certainly part of nature, and I think that there's a place for it in the human realm as well. But our perception that nature is fundamentally a vast competition, that was developed in the 19th century, and I think a lot of that is a projection of the experience of people like Charles Darwin in that society. You know, I mean, the human world certainly looked like a competition red in tooth and claw, you know, and so it's natural to see nature that way. Early people, who we call primitive, they did not see nature fundamentally as a competition. They saw it in terms of gift, of a gift circle. You know, each being had a gift that was important to the well-being of the whole. Yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
Oh, no, definitely very good. I was just waiting if there was more to that, Charles. You're right. I mean, if you check out most animals, they To use a human term, they hang out a lot. They sleep a lot. They spend a good time just, you know, chilling out, basically. And we don't know if they, you know, philosophize on the mysteries of the universe when they're doing that or solving difficult equations or whatever. But then they also have those moments of, you know, fierce fights to the death.
Yep.
And it's a very, you know, extreme environment in that sense. But they are capable of doing that. It seems like even though that they have an extreme challenge of the threat of being eaten, you know, any second, anyone can show up. They don't seem to lack from the trauma from that prospect, if you will, as a human would. So the question then becomes, if we are a product of that same natural world, or if we are outside of that, and if we are, do we have the capability of using the other properties that we have that animals don't have to guide our and direct our lives in a different way, Charles?
Yeah. No, I'm not opposed to some degree of competition, but do we have to create even more of it? And do we have to have the terms of the competition be that the winner is the one who destroys more of nature and converts it into products than anybody else? Like, that's pretty insane. And you can channel competition in other directions. So in many, many ancient cultures, wealth and status, social status, came not from how much you owned or how much you controlled, but through how much you gave. It was the most generous person who had the highest status. And if you wanted to be a chief, or say in medieval Europe, you know, if you wanted to be a king or a lord, you had to give magnificent gifts to lots and lots of people. You're always reading about the king or the lord holding a feast, and all the knights come to the feast, and they all get these gifts. You know, that was part of it. If you didn't do that, you wouldn't stay king or lord for very long. Gifts create bonds. So the king, by giving a rich gift to a visiting knight or something like that, basically he was making him a vassal. He was saying, By the knight, by accepting that gift, said, yeah, I owe you one. I'm willing to owe you one. I'm willing to do you a service because I cannot possibly give you a gift as magnificent as this one. So there's kind of a social dominance even that's encoded in gift. And it's a very different, it separates status from, to a large degree, from material well-being. It's the most generous person who has the highest status.
Is it a transaction, if you will, in a different way? I mean, the a value in that, you know, relation is that there is a reciprocal, you know, relationship in a sense. I mean, and I guess some people in this case would argue then that, all right, you know, you go to your job, right? And so your gift is your time and your effort, if you will, and then you receive a gift back on that, right? And then that cycle kind of continues. But How is the gift system that you're talking about different than the mode that we see it, the version that we see it of today?
Well, it might not be fundamentally different. I mean, it's on a continuum. There's no such thing. Well, it's very rare. It's rare. I mean, maybe there is such a thing as a gift that has absolutely no expectation of any return gift.
Right.
Usually, it's a little bit mixed. So, say in a community. A community is basically a network of people who, among whom gifts circulate. So say you help out your neighbor with a project. Maybe he needs to, maybe he's digging a new garden and he needs to do it before, the growing season. And so you go and help him dig the garden, or you help him fix his roof, or you help him with some project. Now, are you calculating in your head, I'm only doing this because then I get to ask him for a favor?
Right.
maybe that is in the back of your mind a little bit, but also maybe you like him. And also maybe you've internalized a cultural value of helping each other out. This is just what you do, you know? Now, once you've done that, then your neighbor is going to feel obliged to help you if you ask him for help. He kind of owes you a favor. So there is a bond or an obligation created. It's now with a money transaction, it's a little bit different. If you help your neighbor with his roof, and then he pays you, then nobody owes each other anything, and there's no bond necessarily created because the transaction is complete. You know, I've given you, you've given me, and it's over. Barter is the same way, by the way. Barter is not very similar to gift.
Mm.
So I guess, like, you could say that a money transaction is a very, very specific type of a gift transaction, where very often the return gift is worked out in advance. And to me, it's almost an abuse of the word gift to say, yeah, I'm going to give this to you, Henrik, but only if you give me X, Y, and Z in return.
Mm-hmm.
Like, are you going to really feel like I gave you a gift if we agree beforehand on what the return gift will be?
Right, no.
Right, and it doesn't create a bond. It doesn't create a tie between us.
So this would be, in a way, then, this would be, if we look back to old times, if you will, and this would be a voluntary process, if you will. But if you didn't fit into that pattern for whatever reason, and, you know, here's another, you know, harsh point then, but maybe you'd be naturally kind of ousted, you know, through that, mm-hmm. from that community that has a certain set of, you know, maybe unwritten rules in some cases, that this is how you do it. That's, you know, part of their culture.
Right.
But if you don't fit into that pattern, you'll kind of be naturally ousted, if you will. So this would be on a voluntary basis, maybe in the past. That's what you're saying, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, the distinction between voluntary and involuntary is blurry. You know, consider, say, a medieval village in Sweden. That's where you are, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So in a medieval village in Sweden, if somebody isn't contributing to community, isn't helping each other out, then pretty soon everybody's going to see that. And they're not going to really want to help that person out either. And because in that context, you can't just pay for what you need. You can't, who cares about my neighbors? I'll just, you know, hire somebody from the outside. Like, you can't do that in that setting. Maybe that economy didn't even use money very much. You're going to be in trouble when you, you know, break your leg or when you have some misfortune, because there's going to be nobody who owes you one and nobody who's going to want to take care of you. So is it voluntary or involuntary? You know, it's hard to say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know, Charles, if during the, and I've heard this before in other settings, but during the Renaissance, that there were many different currencies. I mean, our monetary system is very set in the way it is. And of course, you described some of the many problems with it when it comes to debt and interest and everything else that comes along with that. But I've heard that there was one currency, if you will, for more, how should we put it, intermediate spending, perhaps, that this was something mm-hmm. that was taking place in the marketplace. You got receipts, for example, when you mm-hmm. you know, came and brought something to the marketplace and the value of that or whatever. But then there were other currencies for, let's say, saving and things like that. Today we use one for the same, for all of it. And that also actually on the side of it creates another set of problems. So have you heard about that?
A little bit. David Graeber describes a bit of that in his book, and I've seen it in a few other books. Often, in a community, people didn't even exchange a lot of currency at all. They would use tallies.
Right.
They would use credit. They would just keep records, you know.
Yeah.
And then every once in a while, maybe every year, they would settle accounts, and then they would use money, because there wasn't even enough money to be circulating all the time, perhaps. So they would essentially, when you make credit, you know, when you use credits like that, you're essentially making your own money. You're expanding the money supply. I think it is useful to begin thinking outside the box in terms of what is money and how could money be created. And I mean, already there are a lot of experiments going on, things like Bitcoin, you know, time banking, all these alternative currencies. I think there's a lot of promise in those. If nothing else, they kind of show us that there is an alternative, that the current money system isn't written in stone.
Well, exactly. Good point there. Now, before we wrap things up here for the first segment here, and of course, I have so much more I want to, you know, ask you about. I want to ask you how you see a reformation, if you will, of the system take place, and you know, going on from there. You know, all the you know, issues that come that arise with that, and you know, where things are, where you think things will go if we continue on the path we're on right now, etc. But let's talk a little bit about some of your website, Charles. We can give out some details of where people can go to find your work. You have copies of Sacred Economics available. You have also have you know, a lot of other books in the past. So please go ahead and mention where people can, you know, find more of your work and pick up copies of your work.
Well, my main website is charleseisenstein.net. The book Sacred Economics and the book before that, The Ascent of Humanity, you know, you can get those online or at bookstores or whatever. Also, I make the content available on the website as well. If you would rather not pay for it, then you can read it without paying for it. And that's, I guess, part of the gift paradigm. I'm coming out with a new book in November. It's already written. It's at the publisher. It's being printed right now. And it's called The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible. Most of my essays and articles and stuff, short films and interviews and things like that are on the website, where there's links to it there.
You talk quite a bit as well, the different talks around the world. Do you have something upcoming you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I'm going to be in Switzerland week after next, Luxembourg, and then I'm back here for a while, and then in November I'll be in the UK a bit, in Norway, actually. I don't know. That stuff's on my website, too.
Well, okay, very good. You guys can simply go to sacred-economics.com and find it from there, or...
CharlesEisenstein.net is better.
Okay, yeah, CharlesEisenstein.net. I was going to give both websites there. So we're going to continue then with Charles here in a little bit. We'll take a short break right here, and we'll be right back.